You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, September 27th, the feast day of St. Vincent de Paul, priest from the late 16th into the 17th century from France, who died in Paris, France, with a deep heart for the poor. Founded the Congregation of the Priests of the Mission, or Lazarists, as they were called, in deference and named for, I'm sure, the poor man Lazarus, who laid at the gate of the rich man for years and years without being seen. St. Vincent de Paul, as we talked about yesterday, seeing with eyes of mercy the poor. He also helped establish the Congregation of the Sisters of Charity. St. Vincent de Paul, whose motto was, God sees you. God sees oftentimes through, what's the old saying? Christ has no hands but yours. He has no feet but yours. He has no eyes but yours. It's through the eyes of his body, the church, that sees the dignity of the human person, even and especially hidden in the poor. 573-4-BREAD-4, if you want to chime in, be on the program today. 573-4-BREAD-4. Maybe you want to talk about the debate a little bit last night, if you stayed up to watch it. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Give me your impression. There is seems to be no clear consensus on who was the quote-unquote winner of the debate. As has been said by some, we know who the loser is, and though that's the American people. What I'm waiting for, honestly, is the bad lip reading version of the debate. That's always much more entertaining. I'm still... And I posted it yesterday on my Facebook page, the 2012 bad lip reading. If you've never seen bad lip reading, you're really missing out on one of the best things that's on the internet, to be quite honest. Go to YouTube and just put bad lip reading. Put bad lip reading presidential debate, bad lip reading NFL, bad lip reading movies. Oh, man, funny stuff. So that's what I'm waiting for. Hopefully that will come soon. We'll have Chelsea Zimmerman on here in about 15 minutes. Chelsea, who's a monthly guest, who has her own blog, reflectionsofaparalytic.com. She's also editor-in-chief at catholiclane.com. She writes often on issues related to bioethics. And we're going to be talking today about our conflicted cultural feelings about suicide on National Suicide Prevention Month. So hold on tight for that. We'll also talk about chimeras. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, though it could be wrong. As I've told you before, I gave a speech my senior year in engineering school. It was a public speaking type of class, but in the engineering department for some reason. And I was talking about a book that I had recently read. I think it was The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, kind of a classic text about how worldviews change and related to science. And there was a word in there that I hadn't encountered before, but was pretty dominant in that book. And I ended up saying the book about the word about 30 times in my speech. I thought it was pronounced paradigm, but it was really paradigm. But all through the speech, I kept referencing paradigm, paradigm, paradigm. Nobody in the class even laughed. And in fact, I got compliments at the end of the speech from the professor for how well done it was. This shows you how old I am. This is probably was like in the fall of 86 or something like that. And I guess paradigm as a word had not really come in vogue. So I am not above admitting that I don't always know how to pronounce things. Chelsea hopefully can help me with that. Anyway, we were talking about the first reading in the first hour from the book of Job. Interesting that it comes up here on a day we're going to be talking about suicide, because it is from the wisdom literature. It's Job's own struggle and question his existential angst, really, in the midst of his suffering about whether life is better lived or not lived, better to have been born or not born. And, you know, it was Hamlet's to be or not to be long before Shakespeare ever walked the planet. Job opened his mouth, as the text says, and cursed his day. Perish the day on which I was born, and the night when they said, this child is a boy. It's a great expression of probably what every human being at one time or another has questioned, whether or not existence at the end of the day is worth it. It's that old saying that I've heard when one person says life is hard and the other person says, yeah, compared to what? There's a lot of truth to that. It is the lot of our life in this fallen world to endure suffering. Here's the thing, you know, of course, and Job was on a journey, as we're on a journey. Job would not experience the fullness of revelation. Ultimately, Job's answer in the midst of his suffering was, you know what? God is God. And there are some things that are beyond human understanding. And yes, Job, when you get to the place where you can stand in the place of God and you can measure the depths of the sea and the lengths of space and all the rest, then you can question the Lord's wisdom, so to speak. In other words, it was really a call to complete and utter humility and docility and submission and recognition of one's own creatureliness. Job, though, not, we always have to see things in context, not only context within the book itself, but context within the whole canon of Scripture. Job, not yet privileged with the wisdom that would come from the revelation of the wise one, the fullness of God's revelation of himself, Jesus Christ, who reveals in his very person not only that suffering is a part of the human condition, even Jesus, the quintessential pure and holy human being, the one who had not been dehumanized by sin, himself suffered grave evil and suffering, such that suffering is part of what it is to be human in this valley of tears, but even better, that it is through suffering that God can accomplish his redemptive purposes. God who redeems that which we see as evil, God now transforms through the cross. And an important thing for us when we suffer as well, our suffering need not be wasted in the midst of it. We were talking at the end of the last hour how I'm teaching this Old Testament class to my students this semester, and we're getting now in the book of Genesis into the story of Joseph and his brothers. I think that's an important point, and I'll get back to that in just a second. Because of this little quirky chapter that's tucked in here in the story of Joshua between Joshua 37 and 39. 37, the story of Joseph, the favored son of Jacob, sold into slavery by his brothers. Genesis 39, about Joseph's experience as a slave in Egypt with Potiphar, how he rose to prominence in Potiphar's household, great trust from his master until he was falsely accused of rape and finds himself unjustly in prison. But tucked in there is chapter 38, this story of Joseph's brother, Judah, and his very dysfunctional family situation. Judah with three sons. The first, married Tamar. The text doesn't tell us anything more than that he was wicked and the Lord killed him. Then Onan, his younger brother, who is charged with carrying on his brother's bloodline and marrying Tamar, refuses to consummate the marriage, spills his seed on the ground, and the Lord kills him too. Then Judah promised Tamar the third son, Shelah, as soon as he gets old enough, he'll marry you too. So Tamar waits. Well, lo and behold, Shelah, the youngest son, comes of marrying age, and he's not given in marriage to Tamar. So she takes matters into her own hands. By the way, this is not an uncommon theme in the book of Genesis. Deception, sexual infidelity, all these sorts of things play themselves out in the pages of the story of God's chosen people. So Tamar, When she finds out that her father-in-law, Judah, has not given the other son to her in marriage, she takes matters into her own hands, really at the time of his widowhood. She finds out he's on his way to a certain place. She goes and dresses herself as a prostitute alongside the road. You can read it for yourself in Genesis 38, veiled, of course. Judah sees the prostitute, says, "May I avail myself of your services?" They go into the tent, do as you would expect. Afterward, Judah says, "I have no payment to give you, but I will bring payment." And she says, "Well, how will I know you'll bring payment?" He says, "Here is this signet cord, my signet, my ring, my cord, my staff," whatever. He gave her several things as surety. And so he leaves this supposed prostitute. He sends a goat from one of his servants to find her to make payment. She's nowhere to be found. Well, before long, Judah discovers that Tamar is pregnant, and he's enraged. How could Tamar, the widow of his two sons, play the harlot? And he calls her in, demands to know who the father is, because the father of that child will die. And she pulls out these objects he gave her as surety, and she says, "Oh, the father is whoever gave me these." It's a great dramatic moment. Judah realizes he's been busted, that he's the father of these children through his widowed daughter-in-law. Later in the show, I'll tell you why this is more than just a quirky, seemingly editorial mistake that this chapter fits, but we'll get into that later. Chelsea Zimmerman coming up on the other side of the break. This is The Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour. You're back on the Mike Allen Show. Hour two here on Tuesday, September 27th, feast day of St. Vincent de Paul. St. Vincent de Paul, pray for us. Here with my good friend Chelsea Zimmerman. Chelsea, who blogs at reflectionsofaparalytic.com. She also is the editor-in-chief at catholiclane.com, and she's a monthly guest here on the program. Chelsea, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
We won't talk football today, because I know you had a painful loss to Tennessee, and of course, my Wildcats at your Florida Gators, not exactly living up to any sort of SEC level of play. So we'll just ignore that, and we'll talk baseball.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So last night you watched the Marlins. You were telling me a little bit about that kind of emotional tribute to Jose Fernandez, who perished in that horrible boating accident.
Yeah, well, I haven't paid a whole lot of attention to baseball this year, but I was turning on the TV before the debate and saw that the game was on, and I tuned in right at the beginning and just noticed the whole game was obviously a tribute to him for the Marlins. It was at home, and they were all wearing his name and his number, and just the whole attitude of the game was. Pretty sobering and just kind of emotional, especially that home run that and I forget who it was. It was the first score of the game. I had never hit a home run in his career, I think, or maybe it was just, this tells you how much I've been paying attention to baseball this year. But you know, he switched his hat after he took one pitch. He switched to Fernandez's helmet, switched sides, and started hitting a different way. Oh, D. Gordon, thank you, who hit the home run. He switched sides and he hit a home run. And he as he rounded, I think about the third base, he just started breaking down, and everybody was cheering. And it was a pretty emotional night. And just, you know, just talking about it on, you know, with the announcers, just talking about his life and that it was a nice contrast to the debate, actually.
And it's a, you know, kind of feels nicely with what we want to talk about this morning, and that is that life is a good. It is a good in and of itself, even in the midst of suffering. You know, it's the first reading today taken from the book of Job. You know, Job, in the midst of his great suffering, curses the day he was born, which it's not an uncommon reaction to suffering, very human reaction. But you notice he does not take his own life. He doesn't talk about taking it. That's the sovereign domain, really, of God. And one of the things that I had noticed that you had posted was actually an article by Wesley Smith in the National Review, who I know you reference a lot in terms of issues related to bioethics, who talks about this sort of internal contradiction we have in our culture when it comes to suicide.
Right. I mean, yeah, life is a good, and we like to celebrate life. And actually, September is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, which is a great thing. And we still are heavy on the trying to prevent suicides, but only some suicides. You know, September is National Suicide Prevention Month, but this September particularly has been kind of a big month for assisted suicide advocates and people who have decided that suicide is okay in other circumstances. And you know, we kind of talked about this a little bit, especially the big headline in the last week was in Belgium, where the first terminally ill, it's there were the specifics of her case I have not been able to find. They weren't released. I don't even think the age of the person was released. I read somewhere this person might have been 17, and that it said terminally ill. I read somewhere else that this person was suffering from an incurable disease. But anyway, this was the first minor that had been granted assisted suicide in Belgium since the age restrictions were lifted a few years ago. And that was major news in the last week or so. 2 weeks, maybe, going on September 17th, I think, was when this story first came out. And, you know, this is considered a good thing by some. A little closer to home, actually, and you may not have heard of this, a 14-year-old girl named Jerrica Bolin. Did you hear about her story?
I did not, no.
She suffers from type 2 spinal muscular atrophy, which is a disease that leaves her in constant pain, and it involves a lot of pain and repeated invasive medical interventions. I think I read somewhere that she had 40 surgeries. She essentially announced this month that she decided to enter hospice care, and so essentially forego any further treatment, and went into hospice care and got off the ventilator and died. And she just died in the last week or so. Now, her death, I mean, technically that wasn't assisted suicide. She just decided to forego any further medical treatment, which is legitimate in many cases. The problem is that her death has been applauded and used as, like, she's become the next Brittany Maynard, who we all know killed herself last year, the woman who had a brain cancer, who had assisted suicide last year. She was how old she was, 19 or in her 20s. This girl was 14. and her death has been used as the next, you know, as a big push for assisted suicide, even though it technically wasn't.
And so we celebrate this in a sense. I mean, yes. You know, because
she was very highly celebrated. Mm. I mean, she was a media darling. And, you know, now I'm free. Where's the quotes from her? I just want to be free. And just relating it, very much related to Brittany Maynard in the headlines, in the news stories, and 14 years old making this decision. And there's some debate on whether she was really on a ventilator or was it just an assisted breathing? Mm. But either way, the way the media is portraying it is definitely was a right to die issue.
Well, we're in this age. I'm here with Chelsea Zimmerman, who blogs at reflectionsofaparalytic.com and editor-in-chief of catholiclane.com. We're in this age, Chelsea, where it seems like we have really deified desire. I mean, that if whatever your desire is, that becomes the absolute truth for you. So, you know, whether it's on an issue related to gender identity or whatever it is, I mean, that is sort of the inner sanctum of the person that is never to be questioned. Your desire trumps all. So the logical, of course, what you could logically then connect and deduce from that is if somebody has this internal desire because of the suffering they're enduring to end their life, then no one dare question that. And yet we continue on with this charade that we are opposed to suicide, and that I guess there are some desires that make suicide justifiable and some that aren't. I mean, it is a contradiction that is simply untenable and can't stand.
It can't stand, and I've said we can't have it both ways, and statistically we can't. We really can't. It turns out that assisted suicide actually increases other suicides. There was a study in the Southern Medical Journal recently that found statistically significant suicide increases in states that have legalized physician-assisted suicide, and it just makes sense. You know, once we start saying that death is an acceptable treatment, quote, for some pain and suffering, it begins to be justified for all pain and suffering. And people who are suicidal can look at that and say, look, see, you know, if we applaud some suicide, I'm feeling bad. I don't, you know, want to go on living. Maybe I don't have a terminal illness or a debilitating disease or something, but I'm feeling awful and I don't want to live my life anymore. I have these internal problems. Yeah, it actually increases other suicides. So you can't have this, you know, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it seems to be what we're trying to do as a culture, that there's some suffering, because there's a logical thing, because once exceptions are made, or, you know, we've seen this in other patterns. We saw this with contraception, for example, it's only in extreme circumstances.
Right.
Then because that once that rational sort of door has been opened, then there's nothing to stop it from being open the rest of the way.
Right. And that's what the Belgium case is a perfect example of. You know, we think, oh, we're going to have these safeguards. It's only going to be in these circumstances. It's only going to be, you know, at a certain age or whatever. And now we're seeing in Belgium, in the Netherlands, I mean, it's open to children as young as 12.
Chelsea, we're going to have to go to break. We'll pick this up on the other side of the break here with Chelsea Zimmerman on Breadbox Media. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hey. Right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on this September 27th, here with my good friend Chelsea Zimmerman, who blogs at reflectionsofaparalytic.com and an editor-in-chief at catholiclane.com. We've been talking a little bit about National Suicide Prevention Month and our internal contradictions in our culture about that. Sorry, I had to cut you off a little bit there, Chelsea.
That's okay. Actually, one of the other things I wanted to mention that has come out in the last, maybe I only just now read about it, so it's not being really widely reported, but apparently the American Medical Association, which has traditionally opposed assisted suicide, is now considering taking a neutral stance, which would be huge. I mean, you know, as big as the assisted suicide movement is, it's moved rather slowly here in our country. And, you know, part of that reason is because of the opposition of doctors and place in institutions like the American Medical Association. So a neutrality position from them would potentially be disastrous for this. It would be good for that movement, but be disastrous for those of us who oppose assisted suicide. So that's another big thing that has come out in the last couple of months. They are going to have an interim meeting in November, and then at its July 2017 annual meeting, they will consider taking a neutral position, which sends a green light to the states that legalizing is acceptable, you know, and that's another direction we're headed here.
It reminds me of a time I remember, Chelsea, back when I was a Methodist pastor, and there was a woman in my congregation who was who had this condition, and she was dependent on a ventilator. And again, I mean, it gets a little ethically dicey there, because certainly we don't have to go to every extreme end to stop death, right? I mean, if death is happening, but anyway, but she, this was a woman who was doing crossword puzzles. I mean, she was alert and everything, but I was with her family and the hospice chaplain. I don't know why I'm making air quotes, but I didn't have a lot of respect there for the person who basically told her, you know, one of her options would be to simply be removed from the ventilator so that she would just go to sleep. And her family gathered around her, said, you know, that they were neutral about the decision, that, you know, it was her decision, and they were neutral. And I thought, well, my goodness, if I were lying there and my family told me they were neutral about whether I killed myself, I certainly wouldn't see that as neutrality.
Right, exactly. I mean, it sends the message. I think family members feel like they want to be supportive. Oh, whatever decision you make, you know, I want to support you. But really, that's sending the message that you don't value their life. That it's okay if they want to go ahead and die. You know, most people in these situations, there are underlying, you know, there are underlying mental issues at play, and they need somebody to fight for their lives when they have lost the ability to do so. And that's what we should do as human beings. You know, I mean, the desire to live, the will to live is what makes us human. And when we've lost that desire, you know, it's up to the rest of us. And when somebody's lost that desire, that will to live, it's up to the rest of us to affirm their life and let them know their life is valuable and it's worth living up to the very end.
One of the quotes here from Wesley Smith, who you link from your blog on this issue. He said, when society supports the terminally ill in committing suicide, it sends an insidious and hurtful message that the lives of the dying are less important and that their families and the rest of us are better if they do die sooner rather than later.
Yeah, it is. It sends that message. And, you know, I remember reading a friend of mine, Mark Pickup, he wrote a good thing on dying time being good time. Like, you know, I'm not I guess, thankfully had to experience it yet, a dying family member. But when people are dying, I mean, that's a time for God to work, a time for families to be together, to hasten that is to kind of lessen that time you have. A lot of healing happens, during that time of dying, and a lot of good can happen in that time. And we shouldn't really hasten that. I mean, or think of that as necessarily something that's bad. I mean, death is a part of life. It is. And there's a natural process to it that should be respected.
We're here with Chelsea Zimmerman, who blogs at reflectionsofaparalytic.com and editor-in-chief at catholiclane.com. Let's shift gears just a little bit here, Chelsea, okay, and talk about another issue you've been sort of sounding the alarm on and that the USCCB has weighed in on, and that's this idea of animal-human hybrids.
Yeah, we didn't get to it last month, but the National Institutes of Health recently announced that it will probably lift a ban on funding human-animal chimeras. Now, a couple of things to know about this. Number one is there are no federal laws prohibiting any of this research, other than one statute that prohibits gestating a human baby in an animal womb. So this is not necessarily something that's like all of a sudden going to make this legal. The question really is whether to make this research easier by giving them federal funds. So last September, the NIH imposed a moratorium on funding any experiments involving the introduction of human cells into early animal embryos. Now they've decided that they want to take that away. So there was a period of time for weighing in on this. The NIH was taking comments. The USCCB weighed in, which I was glad to see. I was wondering where the bishops were on this, actually, because I hadn't seen much. But yeah, and so that period of time, as the comments are not being taken anymore, and I assume we'll see this ban lifted at some point. But again, it's important to understand that this is actually legal, and actually, there was an article earlier this year that described some experiments being done that involved the pregnancies of human pig or human sheep chimeras, although none were brought to term. So I think that's the thing that it brought to light to me, actually, was the fact that it is being done here. It just hasn't been federally funded. And now that's what we're talking about doing.
Is it happening in other countries as well?
I'm sure it is. I'm sure we're not the only ones, but I have not read of specific other cases. Certainly none where anything has been gestated to birth. But it is being done here.
And the idea of creating these hybrids is what, to deal with some sort of genetic deficiencies or difficulties in the human. I mean, does this go along with our genetic enhancement that we've talked about?
Yeah. Well, there's definitely part of that. I mean, not all, mixing human and animal cells is inherently immoral. There are certainly we've tried to grow, I think, hearts in pigs and things like that. As far as church teaching goes, putting animal cells into embryos is unacceptable, as well as gestating a human fetus in animals. That's kind of where church teaching goes. But yeah, I mean, that's the idea is to it's all about treating disease, and I don't know specifically what they want to use, if there are any areas they're using it for right now. Of course.
According to the USCCB letter, I've pulled it up here, and I'll try to put a link to this on the show's Facebook page. I guess they quote one Catholic ethicist, and it touches on what you've said, that the moral limits are, one, the procedures must not involve the creation or destruction of human embryos. Mm-hmm. They must not involve the replication of major pillars of human identity in animals, such as the brain system, and they must not involve the production of human gametes, meaning the basic building blocks of human reproduction.
Right. So what the NIH is proposing funding is putting pluripotent cells into human embryos or to animal embryos. So the problem is they don't know where those cells are going to go. They'll try to coax them in certain areas, but they really don't know. And the worst case scenario would be that the human cells would end up forming human gametes, eggs or sperm, or brain cells within the animal's body. And that's the main issue with this kind of research. So, you know, they don't know what they're going to do. And it's just pure experimentation at this point. And so, but again, what the NIH is proposing is not whether or not this should be done, but whether it should be funded by the federal government. So that's important, I think, distinction to make.
Well, I'll post this on the show's Facebook page. Chelsea, thank you for drawing it to our attention. And thanks, as always, for being on the program. And blessings to you and down in beautiful Pensacola. And God willing, we'll talk to you next month.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thanks, Chelsea. We'll be back with more. We'll get back to Genesis 38 and why it's a chapter that belongs where it does, despite feeling like a out of place text. We'll be back in just a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Fifteen minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Want to check out more about what we offer at Breadbox Media, including considering the possibility of wherever you go to church, your parish having its own stream, which means you'd get all the same programming, all the excellent contributors from coast to coast and across the heartland of this country. You can check out all our whole lineup at breadboxmedia.com, each with their own perspective and temperament and topics, all through the lens of the Catholic faith. But your parish would get the same programming, but during those three-minute breaks, every 15 minutes, your parish could have their own advertisers in there. And the way we have it with the Bless the Yes situation is that your parish would receive half of whatever the advertising cost is for. Think about the people who are on the back of your bulletin, for example. They support and buy advertising on Breadbox Media. Half of the cost of that goes right back to the parish. So it's really a good deal, and the parish can utilize those 3 minutes as communication hub, announcements, bulletin board. The pastor or some other leader in the parish could have a regular feature. It's really a great opportunity. So check it out at breadboxmedia.com. You can also listen to podcasts of all your favorite shows. Check out the different shows you've not heard at through Podbean, iTunes, or Google Play, and subscribe to them as well, and become a friend of your favorite show. All that and more at breadboxmedia.com. Like I said, always a pleasure to talk to Chelsea Zimmerman, who has her finger on the pulse of bioethical issues in this country and developments, and we have to be vigilant. Science devoid of ethics, and an ethics that fall outside the bounds and the jurisdiction of science in terms of our values, our faith. Science devoid of that is a dangerous thing indeed, because just because we can do something doesn't mean we should do something. And I think the same issue applies, or the same constraint applies, when it comes to the issue of suicide as well, and these issues of life and death. So thanks, Chelsea, for all that you do there. Back to what we were talking about earlier in the show, Genesis chapter 38. This strange, quirky little chapter tucked in between the story of Joseph being sold into slavery in 37 in Genesis, and in 39, his becoming a slave of Potiphar and rising to his top servant, only to be falsely accused of rape and thrown in prison. It seems to interrupt the narrative that's when you start to see maybe Genesis as some sort of a pastiche of various traditions, and maybe they didn't know where else to wedge 38. But I would actually claim that chapter 38 belongs right where it does, as not only an interlude. If you think this family's dysfunctional already, Jacob with his 12 sons and one daughter, born of four different women, where sibling rivalry, a constant theme in Genesis, beginning with Cain and Abel, gets taken to a whole new level. And you wonder why this story of Judah in 38 sits here. Judah, Joseph's older brother, who has three sons, as I said, just to review. The first son marries Tamar. The Lord kills him for being wicked. It's all the text says. We have nothing else to go on. The second son refuses to consummate his marriage with Tamar to raise up children for his brother's lineage. Spills his seed on the ground. The Lord kills him. And Judah puts Tamar off. Says he will eventually give her his thirdborn, Shelah, when he's old enough to marry. And, of course, doesn't do that. Tamar takes matters into her own hands. Knows where Judah is going to be traveling down a certain road. She veils herself, conceals herself, masquerades as a prostitute. Judah, in the fine character form of many in the book of Genesis, avails himself of her services, promises to pay her with a goat. He didn't have his wallet with him, I guess, but gives her a couple of his distinguishing items, signet ring and so forth, for her to keep possession of. Well, the person who comes back with the goat to pay off the prostitute can't find her. Meanwhile, Tamar has become pregnant with Judah's child. Judah finds out that she's pregnant. He's outraged that his daughter-in-law has played the harlot. Seeks out who's ever fathered the child so that that person may be put to death, until Tamar pulls out the distinguishing items that Judah himself had given her and said, "The father of the child is whoever gave me these." And Judah, of course, repents, says that she's more righteous than me. Tamar goes on, of course, to have two children, twin sons, Perez and Zerah. Now, you may think, well, maybe this is just in here to show that as dysfunctional as this family already seemed, this takes it to a whole new level of family brokenness. Maybe you think it's just a salacious story, just told for the sake of telling it. But I don't think so. Not only, of course, do you have tucked into this a reminder not to forget about Judah, there's the temptation to think that this whole shift in this story to Joseph, his experience in Egypt, that the whole focus of Genesis is simply onto Joseph, almost like God, who recreated or sought to recreate humanity by selecting Noah and his family and destroying the rest of the world, that through one righteous man he might rebuild, which turns out to be futile because Noah ends up drunk and naked and the family torn apart by division and so forth. You may think the same sort of thing. Out of this morally dysfunctional quagmire of a family, here's Joseph, the one man of integrity who won't yield to temptation. Maybe God's going to rebuild Israel just through this one man, but this story inserted here is a reminder that Judah and Joseph's brothers are not going away. Because this is about more than Joseph. This is about the entire project of Israel. Each of these 12 brothers and 12, or each of these 12 sons representing a different tribe. But you're also reminded of God's faithfulness and fidelity, even in the midst of all this dysfunction. When Perez, who was born of this illicit union between Tamar and her father-in-law Judah, becomes the ancestor ultimately of King David, and of course ultimately then the ancestor of the Lion of the tribe of Judah, Jesus himself. It really is in many ways an image and a portrait of God's providential sovereignty in the midst of human brokenness, this golden thread of redemption through Genesis that even despite the patriarch's best efforts to undo it, God holds the whole thing together. And you'll see that God has a stake in bringing these brothers who so betrayed Joseph back around again, via the famine into the presence of Joseph, ultimately bringing Jacob to Egypt, reuniting this family and holding it together so that it one day may bring forth the Savior. I think it's a chapter 38, as dark as it is. And as I've said, if you parents out there ever say something like, I don't want my child to get all this sex and violence in movies and video games. I want them to do something wholesome like read the Bible. Well, you may want to steer clear of Genesis 38. You may want to steer clear of Genesis on the whole, because as we talked about with Jason Hall last week, the book of Genesis, this is before the moral law presented in the Decalogue of the Ten Commandments, which won't come until the book of Exodus. The book of Genesis just sort of lays it out there without a lot of great moral opinion. But it does show the natural consequences of human misbehavior. But that's some kind of story, man. Genesis 38. Wow. Should give us hope, by the way. If we think somehow that our family's too messed up, I could be a saint if it wasn't for my family. If I just had a more devout father or more devout wife, then I could really be a saint. Mm-hmm. God can make saints in unexpected places, just as he can carry on his lineage through the most broken of circumstances. Praise God. Anyway, let's go on to Dial a Catechism. We'll go to random.org, our random number generator, and we'll spin up the Dial a Catechism wheel. Dial up a number between 1 and 2865. We'll see what Providence has in store. 2516, of course. Truth is never random, always integrated within the panoramic totality of the faith. 2516 is the number. This is in the 9th commandment. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. Here we go. Or you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant and so forth. All right? Shall not covet. Because man is a composite being, spirit and body, there already exists a certain tension in him, a certain struggle of tendencies between spirit and flesh develops. But in fact, this struggle belongs to the heritage of sin. It is a consequence of sin and at the same time a confirmation of it. It is part of the daily experience of the spiritual battle. And then there's a quote here from St. John Paul II. For the apostle, it is not a matter of despising and condemning the body, which with the spiritual soul constitutes man's nature and personal subjectivity. It's not that our bodies are bad. Rather, he is concerned with the morally good or bad works, or better, the permanent dispositions, virtues, and vices that are the fruit of submission in the first case or resistance in the second case to the saving action of the Holy Spirit. For this reason, the Apostle Paul writes, if we live by the Spirit, let us also walk by the Spirit. In other words, we have a choice today. If we've been given the Spirit through our baptism, strengthened in confirmation, we can submit to the Spirit's work, which leads to virtue, or resist the Spirit's work in us, which leads to vice. There's no escaping the dilemma of being a human being. What will we do with it? Lord, have mercy. We'll be back with you tomorrow. By God's grace, this is the Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.